No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or we have a chat box and you can go ask questions there as well. We're going to have an exciting show tonight, I think. We've got two special guests with us, and as always, we have the heart and soul of the show, Maria Sanchez, with us. Maria, how are you? How
are I'm great. In California? You know what? We're getting back to our new normal, and you sound completely energized. What's with your enthusiasm today?
I went to a protest at the Justice Department, and you know what? I've been feeling bad because I see we're going to have our two guests on, Allie and Ace, and I see these young people out there protesting, and I really feel like I should be out there. But as a diabetic with high blood pressure,
yes,
and in the midst of coronavirus, I've avoided
yes.
a lot of it, and I feel guilty, and I feel like you know, my place is with the protesters. And so today I went out with a bunch of religious leaders. I think we had six pastors, and we all got together in front of the Justice Department and had like a prayer vigil.
Nice.
And you know what? We drew a lot of people in who were just walking by and heard us. And a lot of the streets are closed down. We'll have to talk to Allie and Ace about that. They probably experienced more of that than I have. I was surprised to see how much is still closed down. And there's still a military presence in town.
Really?
Yes. And the police are out. I think it's just DC National Guard, but you know, I think everybody's on edge over what happened in Atlanta last night. You know, at least the police are on edge, and they're moving all over DC. You see squads of them moving, and like I say, the guard is still out there. But without further ado, let's get our guests on the show. Allie Conyers came to my attention because she ended up on the front page of the Metro section, and they talked about how Allie inspired the crowd in two big protests. I'm going to let, rather than tell you her specifics, she's 17 years old, I'm going to welcome her to the show, and we're going to ask her to tell us a little bit about herself before we ask her any questions and you know, find out why she's here and what she's doing. So, Allie, are you there?
Hi.
Hi. Tell us about you. Okay, you're a 17-year-old. You're a 17-year-old high school senior, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so what else? You're a track star. You're go on. Tell us how cool you are.
So I'm 17, and this summer I was actually planning on running track and, you know, just doing 17-year-old things, the beach, hanging out, the movies. But, you know, ever since Corona and really the movement, it's inspired me in ways that I never even imagined.
Well, you're a little understated there, Allie. You're not only running track, you're an All-American sprinter. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And wow. what are your events?
So I run the 400 and the 200.
And the 400, that's about a half a mile, is that right?
It's a quarter of a mile.
Quarter of a mile. It just shows you, I was the worst kid on the track team when I was in middle school.
I never liked running, so my hat is off to you. How do you train, Ellie?
So we sometimes do overtraining. So I run the 400, so we'll run 500 or 600. Mm-hmm. And then we also try to master like speed training with like short 40s or 50s.
And what about weight training?
So during the school year, I did weight training about 3 days a week, and then a lot of like stretching and a little bit of yoga.
Because you've got to keep the elasticity going, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, good for you. So the senator tells us that you organized a march. How did that come from your thinking to the actual execution of it?
So actually, the first march that we organized was, I think, 2 Sundays ago, and it was my brother's idea. He and his friend Cam came up with this idea because we went to the very first day of protesting on Friday, and we saw really how it wasn't, you know, an organized protest. There was no specific route. There was no leader, and we knew that, okay, like, if we have a specific route, like a certain way to go, you know, we won't clash with the police as much. We could actually work with them, and we'd be able to peacefully have our voices heard. And so that's basically what we did the first day.
And did you have to get permits or permission to organize and to march?
We didn't have permits, but we just talked to the police officers upon arrival.
Oh, I see.
And, you know, I mean, it's just amazing that you had that presence of mind, Ellie, especially at your age, to understand all that stuff. And unfortunately, according to the Post, Ellie stepped up because her brother Ace was hoarse from shouting. And Ellie stepped up and led this march. And it's great that you had the presence of mind to understand exactly how to do it, to go on a route, to not clash with police. But unfortunately, when you got to Lafayette Park, you were caught in that maelstrom of rubber bullets and tear gas. What did you think of that as a 17-year-old, as a high school student, that you were being attacked by the Secret Service and the police?
It was definitely scary, but, again, it was later at night rather than during our protest. So that happened around 7:30, 8 o'clock. But, honestly, it was very terrifying, you know, to think that the people who are there to serve and protect us and we're begging for service and protection are going to attack us. So it was kind of mind blowing, you know, later that night, I really thought about it. And, you know, of course, the tear gas was painful. My brother hit it a lot harder than I did, but it was a lot. It was rough.
That's really something. The president.
So can we talk to Ellie?
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, Ellie, can you give us your thinking and why it is that you decided to do what you did?
Well.
I'm sorry, your brother, Ace.
Oh, okay, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, I apologize.
Ace, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, tell us. And before you start, before you answer Maria's question, tell us just a little bit about you, Ace, where you are in life.
Yes, sir. Well, I am currently a rising sophomore at South Carolina State University, where I am recently won the SCA Attorney General, and I also am a member of the school's university tennis team.
Yeah,
wow.
Nice.
Wow.
We've got scholar great. Athletes on our hands.
Yeah. So yep, go man. Ahead, Maria. Ask your question again.
So, Ace, I was curious, as I asked your sister, how did you go from having the idea to executing the idea? And did it meet your expectations, what your experience was?
It actually surpassed my expectations.
Oh, wow.
To be honest, I was really just, I was satisfied. I was just hoping it would, you know, not just be my sister, Cam, and one more person. So when I saw about 50 people there, we were like, okay, this is pretty good just for, you know, a 19-year-old and a 17-year-old. But my main reason for this march was, like how Ali said, when we went out there the first time, we didn't see any organization. Well, for me personally, it was about the youth. And we live in Northern Virginia, and the first 2 days we were out there, I rarely saw any of my Northern Virginia friends or didn't see anything on social media of kids from my area out there. So that was my first thing. I was like, I must get my peers that live around me out in D.C. so the media can see that we're out here and this is not a trend and we're going to keep it going and we're going to keep it going. So for me, it was strictly youth.
Well, you know, it's funny to me, Ace, that you said that your worry was that it would be you and Ali and one more person, because that's always the worry when we go into these things. That's exactly my feeling as I was walking down the street to the Justice Department today. I hope it's not just me and the one minister that invited me. So that's something that you always put up with. But as it turns out, the next day after you did the initial march, you guys ended up at the Martin Luther King Memorial. And Ali led 1,000 people in a moment of silence. Isn't that true, Ali?
Yes, sir. So that one started. Our friend Zeta from Northern Virginia, she actually contacted us right after our first march, and she had a dream, you know, from All American Boys by Jason Reynolds. It's a book, and they have, you know, like a moment of silence for people who've died of police brutality, and it's like a kneel or a lie, and she was very, very interested in doing it. And she knew that at that moment, my brother and I, we had the platform, and, you know, a lot of people were willing to listen to us. So we spread the word around through social media, Instagram, Twitter, and it was crazy the amount of people that came out in a matter of 2 days.
Yeah, that's amazing. And, you know, we saw a similar thing happen with the Parkland shooting. The Stoneman Douglas kids put together a protest, and I was there, and I mean, they did it in a few days, Allie, and there must have been, I don't know, close to 100,000 people there.
Goodness.
It was just amazing. The whole street was filled. Well, you know, Allie, one of the things you said, which really, really, really struck me, and Ace, feel free to comment on this as well, is you said enough is enough. And I'm starting to get that feeling, especially from young people, that they're tired. They're tired of the platitudes. They're tired of the talk. They want to see something happen. So tell me, what does enough is enough mean to you?
Well, for me, you know, at a young age, I can remember the first time my dad sat down with me and told me about police brutality you know, unarmed black men being killed. And it was actually Trayvon Martin. And it was a couple weeks after my 9th birthday. And that's just something that I'll never forget. You know, he told me, you know, the value of my life isn't seen the same as his eyes and maybe a white police officer's. And it was terrifying to think that not just me, but my brother and my family, my cousins could be also seen like that. So for a 9-year-old girl to learn that her presence doesn't really matter as much as, you know, her white peers, it's very terrifying and it's very emotional, I guess you could say. But I mean, I've seen racism in my community for as long as I can remember. And, you know, it's more than police brutality and it's more than George Floyd. You know, this is a problem of systemic racism that's lasted not just in our country, but all over the world. And that's why I say that, you know, we're facing a double pandemic, because, you know, this movement has not only changed Washington, D.C. and not only changed America, but there's protests all over the world in every city, in every state. And it's absolutely beautiful, honestly.
So has this changed your idea of what you're going to do when you get to college? Has this changed? I mean, last week, were you a business major and now you're going to be a sociology major? Has it changed your view of the world and what you want to do?
Honestly, it's kind of inspired the idea that I have even more. For the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 years, I've said that I wanted to be president. And so I kind of still stand by that now.
Well, let me just first say that I'm an old guy, but if I'm still around, I'll be your volunteer campaign manager. I think you're amazing, and I think you know there's no doubt in my mind, Ali Conyers, that you could in fact be president.
That's only in 18 years, Michael. You're not going to be that old.
Oh, my God.
Allie, we're going to wait for you.
You and I, Marie, will be sitting on a porch somewhere trying to remember
where
we are. Or at least I will. But, yeah, you know, if anybody can do it, young lady, I think you can. How about you, Ace? What do you study at South Carolina? What are you studying at University of South Carolina?
South Carolina State. My major at the moment is speech pathology.
Oh, great.
And what do you hope to do with that? To be a speech therapist?
Well, a funny story about how I got into that field, per se, is since we were Army brats, I've lived a lot of places. And one of the places I lived was actually, I went to high school, Scotch Branch High School in Somerton, South Carolina, actually one of the schools with the Brown versus Board of Education. Uh-huh. And in that rural area, there's just a lot of speech impediments. So it was like a lot of my friends just had stuttering problems and quote-unquote Ebonics. So when I went there, you know, because I didn't really have a stuttering problem, you know, I was always the, Ace, you talk weird. But I did some more research, and I was like, I really want to help out. Just like even in the NBA, there's many NBA players that come from, you know, towns as in Somerton, South Carolina, small country town with a cornfield across the street from the high school. And when they get to the league, all the press conferences, people want to know what they're saying. So hopefully, you know, they come to me. So, yes, ma'am.
Well, you know what, Ace? You're talking to a guy that was sent to a speech pathologist when I was a kid because I moved here from New Jersey. And I talk like this. This is how this is. I talk like this, and hooked me up with a speech pathologist. And I remember my mother coming and saying, "What's wrong with the way the boy talks? The boy talks fine." So God bless you. Because if you can see, I do occasionally have my Jersey accent come back. My kids tell me that I can't pronounce the letter H. So, you know, but I always say to them, I say things like huge, and they go, there's an H in that, Dad.
It's funny, Michael. I learned English from my parents who speak English as their second language. So they made great efforts to exaggerate things. So we were raised with what, who, where, to make sure that you got that H emphasized. So it was a counterbalance to what they, but my dad came from Chicago. He's first generation American. And my mom said when she met him, he used to say dis, dat, and dos.
Yeah, I did too. And I remember my sister, who was my family speech voluntary speech pathologist. And she used to sit there, Ace, and she would say to me, birthday. And I'd go, birthday. And she'd go, girl, and I go, Goyle. And you know, I remember her going through the whole list. So God bless you for that work. That's important work. And I hope you have a great career. I'm sure you will, especially when Allie becomes president and appoints you to some high position like
Attorney General.
Attorney General, yes.
That's good enough for John Kennedy. Ace, you might want to consider another avenue, which is the one that I've been taking. It's called media psychology, and that's part of my field, is to coach people how to be their best self, either CEOs who are messaging in times of crisis or celebrities or athletes or what have you, so that they can make the most effective messaging with the sound bites that we're always looking for with our 24/7 news feed. And with your speech pathology and then maybe with some psychology, you would be a hidden gem.
Yes, ma'am. Definitely look into that. Thank you.
Yeah. It's called media psychology. I'm getting my PhD in it. So if you want a sidebar with me afterwards, I'm happy to share.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Of course.
Yeah. You know, Maria's just plugging for a job. When Ali becomes president, she wants to be in charge of something.
I'll be the White House communicator.
Let me ask you both, Ali first. Ali, when you were at the Martin Luther King Memorial, you encouraged people to vote. You said, elect the right person who can protect us. You're not old enough to vote. You're not registered. So what do you think about that? What do you think? How important do you think voting is?
I think voting is very important. I mean, at this point, I feel like you can only change the system from within. I mean, no matter what president it is, as long as we don't have justice in our community, we're always going to be fighting for it. So if we elect the right person to protect us, you know, to change the system, to hold police officers accountable when they do things unjust, it will, you know, really make a difference.
Well, I'm ready to vote for you now. How about you? How about you, Ace? Are you registered to vote?
Yes, sir, I am. I am.
And have you voted in an election yet?
No, I haven't, but I soon will be. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
You've got a big opportunity in November, don't you?
Yeah. Yes, sir. I mean, yes, ma'am.
Don't we all? Don't we all?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. So let me ask again, both of you. There was a woman, a young woman that went up there and faced protesters on Capitol Hill, and she asked the black police officer if he had children, and the police officer said, yes, I have two daughters, and she responded to that, well, they're the same as we are. They could be standing here right now. What do you think of that? So what did you see? What was the mood of the police? You know, we saw police officers in different cities kneeling down with protesters. And what sense did you get when you were out there?
Well, so my dad was a military police officer. He was in the Army, and he was retired. He's retired now. But I mean, as I said, I've lived everywhere, and I know that if four military police officers were to do that to a detainee or a terrorist, all four would be charged immediately. You know, and I learned that from living in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. But, I mean, it's not really that every single police officer is bad. It's that the system that they worked for is corrupt. You know, the morals that a lot of them have are corrupt, and that's what we're facing right now. You know, it's not that every police officer wants to harm African Americans, because it's not true. You know, it's that a lot of times they get away with it, and that's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, we saw that last night in Atlanta, didn't we? We saw this man who was shot in the back. He started a fight with the cops. He grabbed a taser, but there was really no need to kill him. I mean, they had his car. They had his. They surely could have let him go with the taser and pick him up later or whatever.
Yeah, of course.
He didn't attack the police. But you're right. It's a culture. And, you know, I grew up in a town where we had it had more black people than any city in America. But I never saw a black cop. We only had white policemen when I was a kid, and it was a really, really racist police department. And here in Washington, we've done a lot better. We have civilian review boards. We have, I don't know if you've encountered any DC police, but DC cops are pretty nice. They're probably like the cops you remember, like the military police. They're helpful and I think we have a top-notch police force. So I agree with you. We don't need to get rid of all the cops. We need to get rid of the bad ones, and we need to change the culture. We need to change the culture.
Yes, sir.
And how do we go about that, though, is my, you know, I know the chokehold thing here in California, they've stopped teaching the cardioid thing, which stops the flow of blood to the brain so that people go unconscious for a little while. But other than that, if we have what we had last night, in the midst of our heightened sensitivities, how are we going to make those changes?
Well, I think that it starts with holding police officers accountable when they do things like this. I mean, specifically in the George Floyd case, you know, you see the police officer look into the camera while he's on top of George Floyd's neck. You know, that was very shocking because he had confidence and he knew exactly what he was doing and he knew there was a camera in his face, but he also knew that he'd probably be able to get away with it, you know, and that's not okay. And I think that's why the protesting is so big, because of his ignorance. I mean, because of his, you know, pride when he looked into the camera, you know, he had so much confidence and pride that he was able to get, that he would be able to get away with it. And I think that's the first step, is holding cops accountable.
Yeah, and, you know, changing the role of police officers, too. I think that, you know, I think that most of us understand when we're saying defund the police that you can't get rid of the police department. But changing the role of police officers, you know, here in Washington, D.C., cops do a lot of, you know, they have a different role. If you go up to the Capitol Police Department, the Capitol Police, which you may have encountered, Allie, when you were up on Capitol Hill, they deal with protesters every single day. They're absolutely fabulous at it. I can't remember an incident where a protester died in their custody, or, you know, they were sued for doing something, you know, that was inappropriate. They're well trained and they overwhelm you. You know, when I was arrested for an act of civil disobedience in front of the Senate. Well, they came over and they couldn't have been nicer to me. But when they stood up and handcuffed me, I noticed that there were six of the biggest, largest human beings I'd ever seen standing around me. And that's what they do. They overwhelm you. And they say, okay, you know, you're under arrest and this is great, but don't try anything.
Mr. Big Shot.
Yeah, and I think that's a great way to do it. You know, is they're not being violent. They don't throw you on the ground and put their knee on their neck. They handcuff you and they say, but you're under arrest. Understand that. You're not going anywhere except into the, you know, the wagon. The wagon that we're going to take you off to jail. So I think training's got a lot to do with it. And you're right, attitude. I mean, you know, you got to hold cops accountable. They shouldn't be above the law. They shouldn't be above the law.
Well, and Ali, to your point about him and his arrogance, I believe, and I know you're not supposed to analyze anybody that you don't meet in person, he has a severe psychological disorder.
He
was killing somebody and he was just fine with it. That's not normal. That there's something deeply disturbing about him psychologically, not just his badge.
Well, yeah. And let's not forget that he'd been brought up before review boards 18 times. There have been 18 complaints against this guy. So that's the other part of it. It's not only you know, the training and the culture, but it is a culture that you can't, as you said, Allie, allow this to be acceptable. You know, you shouldn't have a guy with 18 charges against him out there as a supervisor, especially as a supervisor. He was the supervisor of the people he was with. And, you know, they also, and this is changing quickly in Congress, I think, they also shouldn't be thrown off the Milwaukee police and allowed to go across the river to Chicago and get a job as a Chicago police officer. Mm-hmm. And that happens a lot. We had someone involved in a killing here in Maryland that did exactly that. He was thrown off the police department in Delaware, and then a local town in Maryland hired him as a cop. And he was thrown off for for assaulting somebody in custody, and then he ended up killing somebody. So, Ace, what do you think? What was your experience with the police? Do you you agree with Ali that you know, obviously you agree that we need change, I'm sure, but how did you feel when you were out there, especially with your little sister?
Yes, sir. So, I mean, when I'm with Ali, I do feel safer, even if I'm not with, you know, I guess a quote-unquote bigger guy. But see, my thing with the police is less of the regular police that you see on the street. See, I feel like it starts in the schools. Like, there's a big over-policing problem. So, like, for example, last year I graduated high school in Northern Virginia, like I said, I'm from, as a senior class president. And I felt that I felt that as if at my school, if a white kid has a discipline problem, it's just a bad day for him. But I feel that if necessarily I have a discipline problem, I get the school resource officer called on me. Or if, like, for example, like at my school, we have pods where everybody hangs out after class before you go to your next class. And it's kind of segregated. So you have the black kids on one side of the pod and the white kids on the other side of the pod. But when the bell rings and everybody's still there, including the white kids and black kids, the school resource officer only comes to harass us. They come over and, come on, go to class. And then another school resource officer comes, and then the school security comes. No fighting, no yelling, no cursing, just talking, just late for class, just like any other kid would be. But since I guess we're black, we get the school resource officer calling us.
Well, you know, I have to share a story with you now that you brought that up. I tell this story very often about my son explaining to me when he was about 12 years old about a kid on his team that had scored a goal. My son was a soccer player, and his name was Zach. The kid's name was Zach, and I said to Nick, there were two Zachs on the team. One was white and one was black. And I said to Nick, was it the black Zach or white Zach? And Nick said to me, I don't know what color he was. Which kind of stunned me that wasn't important to Nick. You know, I said, isn't that wonderful? And then a few days later, I was taking his older sister to school at Woodrow Wilson High School, and she forgot her ID. And she said, oh, I forgot my ID. And I said, oh, do I need to take you back to get it? And she said to me, no, I'm white, Dad. They only hassle the black kids. And I said to myself, how horrible is that? How horrible is it that they do it? And how horrible is it that she understands that you know, as a white kid, she doesn't have to worry, but the black kids have to worry. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Where did you go to high school? Can I ask you that? I mean, Ace, where did you go to high school?
I went to South County High School in Northern Virginia.
Yeah, I had to ask you that because Mrs. Brown, my wife, is the head librarian at Annandale High School. So, yeah. So we just have to make sure you're not going to a rival.
You know? Oh, do we?
yeah, because then I can't be nice to him.
You know, I had a conversation. My eldest son came for dinner this week. He's also Nicholas. And he said to me, Mom, how is it that you raised us without having race being an issue? Like, why do we not care? And for lack of a better word, and I hope this isn't pejorative, we are colorblind. And how is that possible? Did you sit us down one day? And I said, no, I just led by example. And because he said it's never been an issue. And it made me think about it, because people who are, let's say, KKK members, they're taught to hate. Like, we aren't born hating people. We're not born. In fact, I dated a black man once whose ex-wife was white, and they had a son, and he was never around to pick the boy up from school. And one day he was. So he went and picked his son up from kindergarten. And the next day, when the son came home from kindergarten, he said, Dad, all of my friends tell me that you're black. Are you black? It's like, you know, that was his normal, right? So that's what I don't get is who foments that because it's not normal. It's not natural. We're not born racist.
Well, right. You know, let me ask both you guys, Allie and Ace, how you feel about growing up as military brats. Because, you know, I think what you're talking about, Maria, doesn't exist as much in the military as it does in the general population. I think the military, because it's been integrated for so long, do you think I'm right about that, guys, that you get a different sense as members of the military than you do in the general population, that the military is more egalitarian in that sense, that race is not as important in the military. Rank is more important.
Well, I do think that we are, you know, privileged of the African-American community because, you know, rank is important when it comes to living on military bases. But I still feel like I experienced some racism while living on these military bases. I mean, you know, I can remember one year, 4th of July, you know, we were playing around the officers and the colonel houses and we were playing with fireworks and, a bystander came up to us and was like, "Hey, what are you guys doing in front of this house? Like, I know the people that live here." And my friends and I were like, "No, because I live here." And they were just, they kind of walked away. You know, it wasn't really like a situation, but I do remember that. And, I mean, also just moving around, you know, my family is from South Carolina, where my cousin's grandfather was killed in the Emanuel 9, and, you know, a classmate's father was killed in the Emanuel 9. So, I mean, I've seen racism growing up, and, you know, the military race, it does shelter you a little bit, but, you know, I honestly don't believe that, you know, you can't really see color, because, I mean, everyone sees color, and, you know, being black, I like people to see my color because I like people to see, you know, the struggle that we've went through and how hard we're fighting, and that, you know, Black Lives Matter, and that this is the movement that we're going for right now. You know, it's our lives that are under attack right now, and that's what we're fighting for.
Well, and I agree with you that. I agree with you, Allie, as far as that's concerned. And I think that the message that my son Nick was saying when he said he didn't know what color the kid was, it wasn't that he didn't know what color the kid was. He didn't care what color the kid was his
point. Right, right.
It was like, "Dad, you know, that's not relevant to the story. You know, what's relevant is the kid's a good soccer player and he made this amazing goal." So, and until this day, I don't know which Zach it was, but it doesn't really matter. I think that's what he was saying, is that, you know, this is not important. This isn't what's important. What's important is his skill on the field. And certainly we've seen that. We've seen that in athletics, haven't we? We've seen that black people the NBA doesn't care what color you are if you can score 40 points. You can be polka dot and you'll get a job. So, no, but I think
unless you're Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah, unless you're Colin Kaepernick. That's right. What do you guys think, as an athlete, Allie, what do you think about Colin Kaepernick? What do you think about a man that gets paid millions of dollars but is using this and has made a great sacrifice in his life, has he not, to bring all this to public attention? What do you think of him?
Well, I was a supporter of Kaepernick since his first kneeling. I mean, it was a peaceful protest. He wasn't out there shouting. He was really just trying to get awareness of a cause that he knew was dear to his heart and is dear to the African-American heart. And I mean, I don't think that it was disrespecting the flag or disrespecting the military, because again, my family stands with the military, and you know, we weren't offended at all. We thought that it was a great idea to kneel for something that you care about.
Yeah, and let me tell you that I put my flag out today because it's Flag Day, and I put my American flag out right next to the poster that's on my door that says Black Lives Matter. So I don't think that there's any, I think you can love America and still, you don't have to love every single thing about it.
Let me just say something about that, how it's a win-win that since he joined Nike, that their stock went up $26 billion.
Is that like, right?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Right. Yeah. So it rose over 18% upon signing him. So I find it obviously that is resonating with people, regular people who are, you know, choosing that brand to buy their sneakers or whatever you want to call them, kicks. So to me, that was a brilliant move, and it was a win-win-win. It wasn't just something that, I mean, I'm sure they couldn't have expected that it was going to kick up their profits that much, but still, I mean, how beautiful is that, that they gave him a job and that his notoriety and what he was doing really resonated with the consumers?
Well, you know, that let me ask you guys, I don't know if you're involved in this at all, but the thing that I found most astounding this week is not only that they have banned the stars and bars, the Confederate battle flag, at NASCAR right. events, but they now have a Black Lives Matter car. I mean, I just found that amazing. What do you guys think? Are you stock car fans? I know South Carolina's right in the middle of all the stock car stuff.
So we actually lived in Kentucky, and I've only been to one kind of race thing. I don't even know really what it was, but we did see Confederate flags there. And for that to happen, it's mind-boggling. You know, I never really expected that to happen, especially with NASCAR. And I mean, I've seen, you know, the one guy quit over the Confederate flag being banned.
Yeah.
But it's
yeah.
really an amazing thing.
Yeah, you know, I was at the Martin Luther King Memorial in Montgomery. No, I'm sorry. It's the Civil Rights Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. And in the Capitol, on the Capitol building, which overshadows the memorial, there was a Confederate flag that flew right under the American flag. And I was there visiting the memorial and visiting family when they arrested a member of the city council who actually went to the roof of the building and climbed up the flagpole and pulled the Confederate battle flag down. So, it's such a symbol, you know, and I know there's people out there that say it's not about race, it's about heritage, but it's about a bad heritage, you know,
right.
It's about a bad history. These guys were not on the right side of history. So as somebody that you guys both seem like you're great Americans. You were brought up with a dad that I mean, your dad must be an amazing guy. I mean, he's a colonel retired colonel who encouraged you to read Malcolm X and James Baldwin. So he must be an amazing guy. But what do you think about them pulling down statues all over the South? You think we should be doing that, getting rid of all the Confederate statues? You think the symbols are really important?
I think that should have happened decades ago. I mean, you go to Germany and you don't see any statues of Nazi leaders or Hitler. Right. I mean, I'm pretty sure that name is illegal anyway. So to see Confederate soldiers and Confederate flags, it's really depressing, because when you look at them and you pass them every day, you know, it reminds you of this depressing history, and it reminds you that these people thought that they were superior. And you know, to see a symbol of hate is really what it is, be so respected, you know, it's scary to think that people still respect a system that, you know, degraded an entire race.
Yeah, and you know, that's certainly true. Nobody's putting up swastikas anywhere, and I reckon, you know, it's not a swastika is not a matter of German pride, and certainly the stars and bars and the statues of some of these people. The only problem that I have with it is, where does it end? It's a slippery slope, because you know, I don't know if we'd be tearing down the Washington Monument and the Jefferson Memorial because they were slave owners. But some of the more egregious symbols, I agree with you 100%. So let me ask both of you now, since we're getting short on time, Is there anything you want to say, Allie, or is there anything you want to say, Ace, that you haven't said, a question that we haven't asked you, anything that you think is important? I know that you, I think your dad is helping you with this, has started an organization called Faces of the Future. Tell us what that's about.
So, again, after the very first protest on Sunday, my brother, myself, and our friend Cam, we started a small, you know, social media organization called Faces of the Future. And as of right now, you know, we haven't really had any specific gatherings, but we really want to do, you know, voters registration and other small things to really just get the community rallied and ready for November.
Do you guys have a website yet?
We don't have a website, but we have an Instagram.
Well, how do we find, tell people how they find you on Instagram.
So the Instagram is Faces of the Future M, with a, which means movement. And so we'll be posting a lot of, you know, pictures of our rallies and dates for the voter registration. And it's really for young people, teens, or early college students is the audience that we're going for.
And are you looking to do this nationally, Allie, or just regionally?
Well, right now, you know, it's pretty big in Northern Virginia, I'd say, but hopefully, you know, this is, becomes a national thing.
Good, because it sounds to me like it's real translatable regardless. It's an age thing, not a geography thing. I said it seems to me that your cause is about people of a particular age, not really where they're located geographically.
Right. I mean, this movement has really, I mean, our generation has really become the face of this movement. And I mean, I think that it's our, you know, it's our best to know what we're fighting for and know what rights we're going to be screaming at protests. And we need to be educated on who we should vote for and what we should do.
Well, you know, since you brought up Instagram and since you brought up pictures, let me just say that the picture of you marching down the street that was on the front page of the Metro Session, we've been using it to promote the show. That's an amazing picture. And you ought to have that bad boy blown up. That ought to be the wallpaper. That ought to be the wallpaper in your dorm room, because it really, you look, you know, you just look so determined, and you know, it's just perfect. The guy, whoever took that shot, I'm telling you, he may get a Pulitzer Prize for that, because the protesters are all there. You know, I mean, you couldn't, if you'd planned the photo, you couldn't have done it better. So that's really great. Hey, Ace, is there something that you want to say that you haven't said? We haven't heard from you lately.
Yes, I would like to say thank you guys for having us so much. And also that we just must continue that this is not a trend. Just because the media portrays it to be cool at the moment, this has always happened. There's so many cases that haven't even been brought out in the light. So for us to just continue the movement and just keep pushing it would really help, because there's so many times where people just do not get the sign that they should get or stuff like that. So
I would like to share something with all of you that came to me this week from my university, actually from our provost, and she wanted to frame the conversation that we're having right now in the academic community. And I'm just going to read two sentences that she wrote, but she said, U.S. higher education was founded by white supremacists who systematically excluded black people and terminated first peoples, respectively, from mainstream American society and institutions. Two, U.S. college and university campuses were built, libraries stocked, administrators selected, faculty hired, students enrolled, and endowments established under the trusteeship of those who amassed wealth from colonization, the sale of human beings, and slave labor. So it stands to reason that the academy is the product, purveyor, and protector of its racist and colonialist founding, development, and operation.
Yeah, how do you feel about that, Ace, going to an HBCU? you know, I would say, Maria, that not only applies to colleges, it applies to everything.
Yes.
You know,
but I just thought
our society was founded
powerful that of course we are systematically racist. We were founded as a racist society 400 years ago.
Absolutely. And Maria and Ace, do you feel, what's your feeling about going to an HBCU? Why did you pick a historically black
Michael,
college?
Let our listeners know what that acronym stands for.
Yeah, it stands for historically black colleges and universities. And they're in Washington alone, in the Washington alone area alone, we have five of them. So how do you feel about that? Why did you pick an HBCU, Ace?
I chose the HBCU because before anything, it was legacy. So both of my parents both went to South Carolina State University. My uncle went to South Carolina State University. My grandparents, my grand uncle, my grand uncles, my grand aunts, my whole family went to South Carolina State. So for me to continue the legacy was just a big process, and that's the only people I, well, that's the people that went to South Carolina State I know. Let me correct myself. The success in my family, a lot of it comes from South Carolina State. So those are my role models. So for me to follow in their path, South Carolina State was the only route for me. So, and also HBCU also gives me that community feeling that I feel like a lot of black people need, just a break from society that's always going to judge them. Like, and it also helps me out because I need small classes because I get distracted so easily. So the small classes is just a big help, but definitely legacy for me. That is the reason I chose the HBCU.
So you made that a conscious decision.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
It is. It's really awesome to hear that. And so we're about to sign off, guys, in a few minutes. Let me first ask you both to do me a favor. And next time you see your dad, tell him I said thank you for his service. I come from a military family myself. My only brother was an F-111 pilot in the Air Force. My father was a combat veteran. My brother was a combat veteran. My family goes all the way back to the Revolutionary War in the military in America. So please thank him for that, especially on a Flag Day. And let me also say, I think Allie Conyers, you just got your first write-in vote for president of the United States. I wasn't sure who I was going to choose, but I think you. I think even
you,
as a Democrat, you've won me over. You really are amazing, young lady.
And thank you.
And sorry that we didn't get more of a chance to talk to your brother, but I hope as things progress, we will be able to have you guys back and hear what you're doing and see how things are going. Maria, do you have anything you want to add?
I just wanted to say that I hope you know that you are inspirational not only to your peers and to people of your age group, but to us, because you are walking the walk, and you're also showing every one of us that if you have an idea and you have a passion and you want to make a difference, you can do it. It doesn't have to just be, on the thinking board. You did it. You executed it. And you can keep doing that with any of your dreams. You can do whatever you want, and you have proven that.
Wow. Thank you so much.
Well,
thank you.
Yes, thank you. And you know what? We always play a song at the end of the show, and we usually dedicate it to our guests. And today we were going to play Rise Up, which has become an anthem for this movement. But after talking to Allie Conyers, it just didn't seem appropriate. So here's Girl on Fire by Alicia Keys. Thanks, folks. See you next week. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, listeners. We appreciate your time and attention.
She's just a girl and she's on fire. Hotter than a fantasy, lonely like a highway. She's living in
the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.